They're coming to get you, Edward.
Carolyn?
Ed, I'm right here.
Ah! What's that?
Is it a bug?
Yes! Wait! No, it has two legs, and it seems to be signaling me. It's beckoning me to a couch, and there's a football game on the TV.
Ed, is it a man bug?
A book?
It's okay, Ed. It's the second LBC book.
The one that Matt Cheney picked? What does this have to do with the Steelers?
Matt Cheney will explain everything.
Matt, you've nominated Man Bug by George Ilsley for the LBC. Tell me a little bit about Man Bug.
Man Bug is a strange and wonderful story about two people in love, one of whom has Asperger's syndrome and is an entomologist, and the other describes himself as a dyslexic bisexual.
What made this book of all the zillions that you see jump out at you?
I had to ask myself that at first, because what happened was I received it as a PDF, and I read it on my computer, and I never read books on my computer because they're just too long. But I couldn't just tear myself away. I found the characters so interesting and the situation that they were in so well expressed that I read it all in one sitting, which almost never happens. And so I thought, well, if it can do that to me, maybe it will do that to other people.
And was there anything about what we've done before in the LBC that you... Like, does this have a place in the LBC arc?
Oh, there's an arc of the LBC?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm new.
I don't know. You know, I intentionally tend to nominate books that are from small presses. I just try to find really hard-to-notice books. Not because I think that's what the LBC in general should be doing, but it's what I like to do. And so I have, with both of, this is the second book I've nominated. The first one was Our Napoleon in Rags by Kirby Gann. And with both of them, one of my criteria was I could never have seen it in a bookstore. And although I live in New Hampshire, we do have a few big bookstores. and I had never seen Man Bug in a bookstore. I had really only seen it listed in a catalog from Arsenal Pulp Press, which published it. And then I read some pieces of it online, and then I asked for the full manuscript to read because it was intriguing. So for me, it was really a matter of, can I find something that holds my attention first as a reader? Because I encounter so many books, any book that holds my attention, by my definitions, has something good going on with it. And then I wanted to find something that felt like it needed us to bring it to the attention of the world at large.
And what would you say are the qualities of Man Bug that you find the most engaging or outstanding or that would recommend the book to others?
I think that the voice of the book is very important, and I think that the narrative structure is very important. Those are the two things that stick out for me. Because the narrative is so tied to one of the characters, who is the narrator, but the book is told within the third person, so we don't realize this until later. And the narrative then becomes all about, the book itself is him trying to work his way through the challenges of this relationship. And so I think it's fascinating. It's a rare book where the narrator is writing it, hiding himself as the narrator and using the writing to figure out what's actually going on. And that kind of complexity is something that I think makes it a rare and wonderful read. And then the voice, because the characters are so odd and specifically odd in interesting human ways, that comes through through the diction, through the syntax, through the wonderful language within it that is very plain and straightforward but conveys a tremendous amount.
Well, and if I would add anything to that, it would only be that it's sort of, I love that it's sort of a failed love affair.
Yes.
Or a failing love affair. And and it's funny.
It is funny. And it's full of sex.
That's true.
And analysis of it, because our narrator is a scientist. And he has a very detail-oriented mind. And so you begin to realize that the reason he's writing about things the way he is an expression of how he perceives the world and how he tries to figure it all out, which is very funny also. But it's not, I think that sometimes if people read little pieces of it, they would assume it was pornographic, but it's not at all.
And I talked to George Ilsley. He said that that he was in part inspired by Kinsey, who started out as an entomologist before becoming a sex researcher.
Well, you know, I first read the book while I was in a class, a graduate course at Dartmouth on sexuality and science. So we were doing a lot with Kinsey. So I think maybe I really connected on that level to it as well. That's really interesting to hear.
Well, it was a great read, and I thank you for picking it. It was excellent.
Oh, I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
There's a lot of things I want to talk about with you with this book, but let's start with the characters. We've got Sebastian and Tom, and Sebastian is a gay entomologist, and Tom is a dyslexic bisexual.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what was the inspiration for those characters? Where'd they come from?
I'm not sure entirely where they came from. Sebastian is the character that I worked with first, and I've had this gay entomologist character in my head for quite a while. Some of it, I think, actually came out of my own childhood or out of my own... in my short story collection, there's a story called The Boy Who Loved Bugs, and it's the boy as a child whose love of bugs got kind of squashed out of him. And so, in a way, that's an extension of that character. Instead of being diverted from nature and bugs, whether he grew up and became an entomologist. And then the character Sebastian maybe has Asperger's syndrome. And a doctor friend had mentioned this to me one time, and I found it to be quite an interesting metaphor for so many things and how we understand the world and how we try to organize the world. And so then somehow the two got together, the entomology and the Asperger's, and I came up with this character, Sebastian.
There's a lot of play with language in the book, like dyslexic, bisexual, it just sounds funny together. And,
yes.
And when you said that in your short story collection there was a boy who loved bugs, but that love gets squashed out of him.
Yes.
It's also really funny. And I didn't want to laugh over you, but that play with language really comes through in the book. Is that something that comes naturally to you or something that you work on?
I think the language play is part of my own creative expression as a writer, an enjoyment of the language and enjoyment of the possibility of the language. Words can mean so many different things, depending how they're used and what other words they're paired up with.
And what's fabulous, I think, in this book is that then you have quite a challenge, since the story is sort of told through Sebastian's point of view, and he has Asperger's syndrome. That really limits the kind of, it changes how he uses language, as opposed to a narrator who didn't have it might. And could you talk about that a little bit? Like, what was it like sort of getting into the head of somebody with Asperger's?
Well, I don't really declare he has Asperger's. It's suggested that maybe he has it. This is an explanation for why he has it. And my point there was that we're all on this spectrum of behavior. And so maybe he has it. So I really didn't try to clinically approach it as if he had it, but I did try to approach it as if he had difficulty understanding the world. And then most of the book is Sebastian trying to understand the world and repeating what he's learned. This is his research project. And I was inspired by Kinsey here. You know, Kinsey, the sexologist, used to be an entomologist. He started with insects and then moved on to human behavior. And that was a bit of inspiration, too, for the book. It's instead of researching thousands of people, Sebastian's just researching one. And that one person he's researching is this dyslexic bisexual who seems much more comfortable and fluid in the world. He's trying to understand the world through Tom, which gets to be funny right there.
Because Tom has his own set of issues.
Yes. And he's much more able to move through the world freely with men and women and with sexual expression, the spiritual pursuits. And he just does it, which people do. They just do these things. And other people look at them and say, well, what is that? What is he doing? Why is he a Buddhist? You know, why is he doing that? They don't understand. But Tom doesn't question things like that. He just does it.
This is really Sebastian trying to come to terms with this love affair that that even as the book starts, we're told that the love affair is over, I think.
Are we?
Aren't we? He says it lasted for 6 weeks. No?
He's saying in the first 6 weeks they made out a lot, which changed after they started living together, which, you know, is not an unknown story in the world.
Sadly true. I don't want to get too far into the end, but it does feel like a relationship that's maybe not evolving in a way that, to me, it feels like it's evolving in a way that's winding down.
Yeah.
Did I misread that?
No, I think it's ambiguous what's happening, and it was deliberately ambiguous because I want it to represent a real relationship. I don't know if you ever look at friends who have a relationship and you don't know whether they're on again or off again or maybe what they see in each other or why it's working for them, but they still continue to go on or else they don't. And other people looking at that often don't understand it. And in a way, it's a reflection of Sebastian here. He's not understanding what stage the relationship is at or where it's going.
I really love that at one point you have him thinking about the relationship and having an addiction to a column that's about relationships that's called Brute Love, which seems like
yes.
A very, not very veiled reference to Savage Love by Dan Savage.
Yes.
But it's so few things in this book actually locate the story in place or time, but that kind of does.
Yes,
that kind of says it's a contemporary moment. Was that deliberate to have it be more fable-like?
I was going for a fable-like. Like there is no setting in time or place, and there it's true what you say. There's very few references to modern things, except for one or two little things. Sometimes there was place names in it, and they were taken out in editing because they were anomalous. Like if you don't have a setting, then don't have a setting. The Brute Love thing it's a bit evocative of Savage Love, but it's also evocative of the love of brutes, the love of men. It's Sebastian's pursuit in the world of men. You know, he keeps talking about the world of men and loving straight men as well. That's the kind of love that's explored in the book.
So let's talk about that. Like, as a straight woman, am I not allowed to read Man Bug? Like, who's your intended audience?
Are you, you're in Pittsburgh, are you not, which is the gayest city in the world?
It is not.
According to Queer as Folk. According to Queer as Folk, it is.
There would be more handsome guys wandering around if it was the gayest city in the world.
And who was the audience for Queer as Folk was actually straight women. The largest audience share was straight women, in terms of numbers.
So,
like, gay men and women watched it too. So straight women liked Queer as Folk, the show, for whatever reason. And also Brokeback Mountain, is that a love story that's just for a particular audience, or is it supposed to be universal?
No, I'm actually, I mean, I am, I loved this book, and to me, it's a love story that is told in the most unique way, because I think Sebastian is such an engaging narrator, even if it's not exactly Sebastian, sometimes it seems like it's somebody sort of helping Sebastian think things through things.
Well, I think he's trying to understand things, so he's coming up with ideas that are different than what he might come up with. He's trying ideas out at times to see how they feel to him. He's trying out new truths and new realities to try and expand his world.
Once you kind of hit on his voice, was it something that came naturally to you, or did it sort of come out in the editing? Did you spend a lot of time refining it?
Well, it came to me at some point, but when I went through my desk and was cleaning it off, it's like an archaeological dig through layers of drafts. And I see it goes back 5 or 6 years when I first had this gay entomologist, and I was trying to write it, and I was trying to write it in a more narrative voice that wasn't working. And then after 2 or 3 drafts, it came across this more deadpan voice or more of a clinical kind of approach, which I felt right. And then I went with that. And I was trying to also to have a voice for Tom that was separate in the book, and I never achieved that. So at one point I was going to have the two voices, one for each side of the relationship. But then what developed was Sebastian portraying both sides. Like when he's talking about Tom, he's really talking about things he's learned from Tom or pillow talk, stories he's heard, things he's trying to figure out. He's really giving us Tom as well, or his view of Tom.
They may be the two most, he may be the most unreliable, or the two most unreliable narrators around.
Yes.
Because Sebastian even acknowledges that Tom's stories may just be stories, and a couple of times he reminds himself that he doesn't really trust the stories that he's getting from Tom about Tom.
Yes, and that's something maybe people sometimes find themselves doing. They're in bed with somebody, and you're saying, is this a true story, or is this a little bit enhanced? am I being misled? Am I being, you know, it's a very pillow talk kind of question people ask themselves. Am I getting the truth here?
And I think that enhances the feeling of being in Sebastian's head in a relationship. When you're in a relationship and there isn't really a firm external reality, it's just whatever is happening between the two of you, which seems to sort of move back and
yes.
forth.
Yes. And that was that was the reason the setting is there's no real setting, is because I wanted the focus to be on their relationship. And outside of a political realm where there's questions of gay marriage or social disapproval or anything like that, it doesn't really exist. Their whole relationship exists between the two of them. It exists entirely in Sebastian's head, is what we see. And ultimately, that's what happens. Our own reality is ultimately entirely in our head.
It's broken out into five parts, and you've got
there's six?
And there's an inscription that heads off each of the sections.
Yes.
I'm wondering if the Kinsey quote is actually a genuine Kinsey quote.
The one where he says men are just larger, more complicated Gaulois?
Yes.
Because
you are writing fiction.
Well, it was in the movie. And I believe it was also in some of the biographies I read. Like, there's a biography of Kinsey underneath of it, the James Jones ones, which is not considered that reliable. It's more sensational. But Kinsey was mad for Gaulois, you know. And I believe he did say men are just bigger, more complicated Gaulois, because it's a quote, at least it's a quote I've seen attributed to him several times.
It just fits so perfectly in your story.
Yeah, well, I didn't make it up anyway. That's my point. I didn't make it up. It was a quote I found, and it seemed to be something Kinsey would say. You know, today in the Museum of Natural History, and I'm not sure where it is in the States, there's an entomology collection of 18 million insects, and the largest single collection is more than 5 million gall wasps collected by Kinsey.
So this leads me to another question I wanted to ask. There are these really grand and detailed description of insects and bugs that are sort of intermittent obsessions that Sebastian has that feed into the narrative. And I'm wondering, how much research did you do, or do you have a sort of encyclopedic knowledge of bugs yourself?
I'm interested in nature in general. But I did a lot of research for this book, and then I did specialist research into surface parasites. You'll see almost all the insects in the book are things that are on the surface of the skin or just under the surface of the skin. And so those are the things I specialized in, and then I looked at especially into these bat bugs, which are related to bed bugs. I had books in the library with huge photos, and in fact, I had to give up doing research because the insect world, and I do say this in the book, that there's so much going on that you'll never learn at all. And there's so many mysteries about how these amazing little creatures function that you'll never learn at all. It's all full of mysteries. It's still full of mysteries, the whole insect world. Well, the insects are really important in our economy, not just in terms of things like producing honey, but also in all the agricultural crops and food recycling. At one point, I was going to write this whole thing about dung beetles going to Australia. I still might write that story. There was a whole search in the world for the proper dung beetles to take to Australia because they didn't have dung beetles. And so they couldn't have cows and sheep because the pastures would just quickly become covered with manure and then nothing would grow anymore. So they couldn't have a cattle industry without dung beetles. There was a search in the world for the proper dung beetles that were acclimatized in Australia. And then I realized, well, that would be a whole new book. That would be a whole separate book. So I really had to try and be focused. And then, so my focus for Man Bug did focus on these kind of human parasites that are on the skin or just under the skin. Bed bugs is something that arose in news reports while I was writing the book. I don't talk about it very much in the book, except they're related to the bat bugs. But bed bugs are symbolizing now a lot of the issues in Man Bug in terms of we have an insect, and the first reaction is spraying that insect with a poison and killing it. And then the result is often that place is too toxic then for people. And bed bugs, I don't know if you've heard, but they're growing in in population, and they're in luxury hotels, and they're immune to poisons now, and they're a real problem because people get them and they can't get rid of them because they live in a crag for a year and not eat. And you spray a place so toxic that people can't live in it anymore, but the bugs are still living. And in a way, that's sort of the metaphor for the planet. Like, we're polluting it so much that life won't exist anymore, except, you know, be cockroaches and dead bugs and things like that.
Yeah, I know that New Yorkers were having problems with just terminal bed bugs. Like, people would have to basically move out and throw out everything they owned.
Yes, I've heard about that. People in New York in nice places that are in tears at the exterminators because they never had bugs before, and now they have bed bugs. And here in Vancouver, it's a problem because there's people put their bedding out in the street, and they move and throw out their mattress, and somebody else salvages it, and then, you know, the bugs are just spread around. And they're tough. They're tough. They live in a cave. They come from some cave, and they live in bat guano in some cave, and so they're quite happy to live with humans. It's a step up. The luxury step up.
I kind of liked that he's got this thing for bat bugs, because it made me think of, you know, like, it's sort of the insect version of a superhero. Like,
yes, in a way.
Like, if Batman had bugs, he would have bat bugs.
Yeah. That's really funny.
And in some ways, Sebastian is a little bit like a superhero because he's apart from how normal people, because it's like he has a gift that also sets him apart. His gift is that he's a scientist and he looks at things in these little minuscule ways. But he can't.
Yes.
He can't see the picture the same way other people do.
No.
But he's funny. Go ahead.
Well, I'm glad you think he's funny. Like, there is a big death theme in the book, and but at the same time, I think it is a funny book.
Now, I have to ask. Tell me a little bit about the big death scene.
The big death scene.
Mm-hmm.
Which big death scene is that?
You said there's a big death scene in the book.
A big death theme.
Oh, big death theme. Okay.
Theme, yeah.
I saw on your website that somebody called it a book about murder, and I was like, wow, I really missed that.
Yeah. Well, that was a reviewer in Boston. I don't know if you found the review, but they took something on page 19 and matched it to the ending and said that it was a murder story, like implying that Sebastian had murdered Tom because of what had happened at the end. And at page 19, it says that if you love something too much, you kill it. And he learned that as a child. He's talking about childhood pets and being obsessed with them and never leaving them alone.
Right.
If you love something too much, you kill it. And they took that to mean that he killed Tom. Which, you know, you can interpret it that way. I don't say it, but the opening is there.
I was surprised by that interpretation. So.
Yeah.
But it's an open ending.
It's a bit forced, but it's there. Well, people usually see them broken up by the end, where it's open there, too. I think there's a possibility. The last section is called The Many-Legged, and I think there's a suggestion that he continues to have some sort of relationship with Tom and Tom's new family, that he's still involved in that in some capacity.
I want to ask you about the synesthesia, is that right?
Synesthesia?
Synesthesia. He's sort of a synesthete, right? Or is that just how he describes the way, like, he uses colors to describe intuition or feeling?
Well, I've never used that word in the book. I kind of forgot, and it was going to be on the cover, but nobody could say it, and nobody knows what it means. But I didn't make that up either. Synesthesia is, in Sebastian's case, he is seeing colors when he hears certain words or certain sounds, which people have it. Like, a siren will go by, and some people see colors in their head in response to these noises. And it's amazing to me how the variety of human perception and human sensory abilities. Again, it's that whole spectrum of behavior. Like, Kinsey had us all in that scale of behavior. And in synesthesia, again, it's a spectrum of behavior. Maybe it's just a few people that have it, or they have it in different ways. But as a human race, there's a whole range of perceptions that we have, which makes us stronger as a race, because we're different.
A lot of authors that I've been reading lately have been dealing with these sort of different modes of perception as, I think, sort of a way to get at narrative, like how we tell stories.
Yeah.
And so you limited your language, but you also have a guy whose brain is sort of doing these crazy things. Or not crazy, but remarkable things. He's remarkable in his own way. Is that is wrestling with narrative or how people perceive the world, is that something that is a common thread among your work? Because I haven't read your short stories, I'm sorry.
Well, my short stories are more conventional in their framing. Like, there's usually a little plot or a setting or something like that, which might surprise you that I do have settings. In Man Bug, I know there's not a lot of plot, but my structure is based on the evolution of consciousness as viewed through this one character. And as a metaphor, I kind of intend it to mean as a human race, or as a evolution of consciousness for human people. I know that sounds pretentious and reaching beyond my grasp, but it, for Sebastian, it's his development from an isolated person, isolated within his own head, through him trying to reach out to other people and trying to understand the world through another person. And at the end, my whole big plot thing is he describes himself as I in that letter to Brute Love at the end. That's my big plot achievement in the whole book, is he uses I to describe himself instead of using the third person.
I'm guessing, but I don't know much. Are the five stages, is that a Buddhist thing that I should know about more specifically?
No.
No.
You see, there's six sections in the book. Is that where you're getting the five?
Yeah.
From?
When you talk about the stages of man, what is your referent, or stages of evolution?
The development of self-consciousness, development of awareness. There's a section called awareness. And so we see Sebastian developing self-awareness and developing an awareness of how he fits into the world. And I think that's an evolution of consciousness that's going on right now on the planet. I give myself permission just to speak freely about anything I want. So I'm sure it doesn't reference anything. I mean, my own inclinations are Buddhist. I do try to have some Buddhist teachings in there about awareness and about knowing the mind, being able to see the mind. Like, I think many people do not see the mind. The mind just works, and they're sort of unconscious of how it's working and what is happening. In Buddhism, it's called the ordinary mind, where it's just churning out your grocery list and what you have to do today and self-talk and that sort of stuff. And then there's a leap of consciousness that people do, a step towards enlightenment, where you are able to see your mind as a separate entity. You step back and you're able to see the mind. And that is a step in consciousness that I've tried to evoke in this book.
I think it's interesting that Tom is the, as the spiritual one, doesn't seem to be on a really excellent path. It seems like he's involved with people who are using spirituality as a kind of a scam, or at least that's how Sebastian sees it.
Yeah.
It's like he's a little bit lost, or gullible, or just doesn't care. So I guess my question there is, you've given yourself a paradox, because the not spiritual character is the one who's moving towards awareness, and the spiritual character is a little more stuck or static.
Yes. Well, you see, the non-spiritual character, Sebastian, becomes very interested in what it means to be spiritual, and the question of spirituality, and what is about spirituality versus what is, you know, cult behavior. And all these questions, again, the cult is, there's no yes or no answer on a cult. It's also on a spectrum of behavior. And with Tom, he's just involved with things, and maybe he's expressing his childhood issues with his involvement in the group he's involved in. And he doesn't question things so much because he's involved in them. He's in the middle of them. Sebastian is an outsider perspective, and of course, that means his perspective is, he has a different view on things. Be questioning everything.
There's a very funny yoga scene in which Sebastian tries to he tries to go to a yoga class, and he just can't get with the program.
Yes.
Have you ever witnessed such a disconnect?
No, I haven't witnessed some of that. I made it up. I had fun with Sebastian once I felt like I knew his voice more. He amused me. I mean, it's weird for a writer to say that because it's coming out of your own head. But in a way, the characters develop a life of their own, and they do things just like a friend that can surprise you or amuse you. And so I'm glad you like that yoga scene because it's one that has made me chortle. Which makes me feel, you know, egotistical because I'm laughing at my own work. But it does seem funny, like that whole contrast of him going there and trying to remember not to talk and whatever.
And trying to buy into the yoga without actually being able to do it. Can we talk a little bit about the sexuality that's in the book? Because it's, well, there's a lot of, like, sort of sexiness going on. There's not a lot of actual sex. And I'm wondering, were you conscious about where to draw the line?
So, some people think that this book is about nothing but sex. And so you're saying there's not a lot of actual sex? There's just talking about sex?
Well, there's a lot of, I guess there's some actual sex, but I guess there's no, so much of the book is in Sebastian's head. That there's not, like, a sex scene. There's, like, maybe one sex scene. But it comes across more as, like, talking about the commonalities of certain sexual experiences. Or what he likes about, you know, hugging from behind.
Yeah. So what is your question?
My question is, were you... I guess it is all about sex, and I was wrong. How much were you conscious of writing about sex in a piece of literature? Did you want to put in more? Did you want to put in less? Or did you just sort of go with it? Whatever it was.
Well, I don't remember censoring myself. Most of it, I think, is coming out of Sebastian's voice, and it's the things that he is interested in mostly. You know, he's interested more in chesting, what I call chesting, or hugging from behind. These are the things he really likes, and the things that he likes, he does talk about. Different body parts that he likes, he talks about. But other body parts that might be more typically male, he's not so interested in.
A lot of armpits, not a lot of balls and dicks.
Right. You know, after I had finished Man Bug, I was reading another book, a gay book, and on page 3, like, the whole page was involved describing somebody's genitals in quite detail. And I was like, oh my God, I forgot to put cock in Man Bug. Like, I realized there was no cock, and there isn't. There is no description in cock. We don't...
No, there's a little bit of spunk, but no cock.
Yeah. Well, some people are really into it, and some people aren't. I don't think Sebastian really is. He doesn't really care whether somebody is cut or uncut, or whether how big they are in there or not. He's more interested in, you know, what their eyes look like. He's more interested in... how he feels when he's around them.
And so the sex that's in the book is really sort of about this relationship, or what else feeds this relationship, or starves it.
I think the sex in the book reflects Sebastian's obsessions and his interests.
Is Sebastian a character that you would want to revisit, or do you think you're done with him?
I'm not quite sure. Like, I did start writing the sequel when this book was freshly done, because I didn't want to say goodbye to Tom and Sebastian. I realized at the time that this new project was really me not wanting to say goodbye to these characters. And I've got over that a bit. Like, I'm not sure whether I will go to it or, you know, work on the screenplay that'll be the same characters. I don't think I'm done with the characters, especially when I hear people like you saying, talk about unique voice or how much you enjoyed the book. I start to get all puffed up.
You told me that you are working on something new now in Man Bug. It's been a while, and so you went back and you revisited the book in preparation for this interview, and I'm wondering if there's anything that jumped out at you or surprised you when you went back to it, sort of as a finished piece after a break.
Well, I didn't get through the whole book when I went back to it, but there are things that surprised me, because I seem to be able to forget things that I wrote. There's things that amuse me. Some of the little footnotes amuse me. So I'm a bit surprised sometimes by some of the things that are said in the book.
I was going to ask you, one of the very funny things about awareness You write, the Sanskrit word for awareness is S-M-R-I-T-I, which no one can pronounce. This may explain why awareness has not become as well known in the West as karma, dharma, and nirvana.
Yes.
Which cracks me up. Could you give me an, could you make an effort at pronouncing S-M-R-I-T-I?
Well, you know, I'm not a Sanskrit scholar. I mean, that is the Sanskrit word for awareness. And when you see it, you do think, well, that's why people don't say Smriti or whatever it is. Smriti, I would say. Smriti. But there's never been a band named Smriti.
Yeah, or a sitcom with Smriti and Greg.
Right.
I really want to focus on this book, but I'm curious what you're doing next.
What I'm doing next? Right now I'm working on a book called Like Gods, and it has a setting and a place. It's set in Vancouver in the summer of the year 2000, and it's about a couple of people who have moved here. There's a lot of history in it, a lot of history of the West Coast, history of Canada, which is sort of easier to do in Vancouver because it's only 100 years of colonial history. Where in the East, it's true, on the East Coast there's like 400 years, and then everything is sped up out here, so you can see history happening at a much faster rate and seeing everything that happened on the East Coast happening here almost before your eyes. So it's quite a different book than Man Bug. And I was working on it before Man Bug, and I'm getting back to it now.
Sounds like it's also fed by research, though, or getting into stuff in detail.
There's a lot of research, historical research, which I've sort of done already, and now I'm just trying to condense it and use the bits and pieces for the framework for the actual narrative story, which takes place over the summer in 2000. So the intersection of people's personal lives plus the historical framework. One of the guys is a writer, and he is wanting to write this history book about Vancouver. So he never really writes the book, but he talks about different ways he can approach the book, approach the history, approach the story of the city, without ever actually writing the book.
Yeah, he leaves the hard work for you.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm not writing the book either. I'm just talking about different ways one can approach a different story.
Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship with Arsenal Pulp, the publishing house that put out Man Bug?
Well, Arsenal is, they've been around for like 25 or 30 years, and now they're becoming a sort of a mid-sized press in Canada instead of a small alternative press. They have a special interest in publishing gay and lesbian material, and the first gay anthology published in Canada, they published in 1993, called Queries. And that was also my first published story. It was in that book. So I've had a relationship with Arsenal since 1993. And then they brought out my short story collection in the year 2003. And so now this next book.
And so have you worked with one editor there, or has that changed over time?
It's changed a bit over time. I'm working, I worked with one editor for Man Bug.
Was that a fun process, or one that's painful, or just, do you enjoy the editing process?
Well, in a way I do enjoy the editing process, because things get better with an editor. Like, I enjoy the writing process and the freedom of that, but if I'm perfectly honest as a writer, I know that my work has always been better after it's gone through an editor. And so I enjoy the process of an editor, even though it can be annoying at times if somebody presumes to question one of my words. But ultimately the work gets better. And so on that level, I enjoy that somebody else is taking the time to look at my work and helping to move it towards an achievement. You know, it's often cutting stuff out, stuff that didn't make it into Man Bug, little bits and pieces that didn't work as well, and you don't see those ones, and so your impression of the book is different than if you had to wade through the material that wasn't quite as good as the rest. And the editor helps in saying, let's just take out this footnote, George. George, you don't need that footnote.
Most of the footnotes work really well. The ones that are here still, anyway.
The ones that are there, yeah. But there's other ones that were like, you know, George, it sounds more like you and not like Sebastian. And I'd be like, you know, sometimes it would take me a couple of days, and then I'd be like, you know, you're right. It is more me than Sebastian. It is the writer sticking his nose in, whereas really we wanted to have a focus more on Sebastian's point of view of the world.
Now, the cover is a sort of a minimalist cover of Manbug. It's white, and there's a ladybug, and the ladybug is on skin.
Yes.
First of all, are you cool with the cover? And second of all...
I love the cover.
I love the cover. I like the cover, too. Second of all, would you like to hypothesize what part of the body the ladybug is sitting on, or would you rather not?
Well, people are confused by this cover. Like, so many people have said, well, what is that body part? Whereas it really doesn't seem to me that confusing. It seems fairly obvious what body part that is. And also that the ladybug is male.
Oh, well, I have no way of telling. You know that the ladybug is male?
Well, you can see, because if you look, you have the book there.
Yeah.
If you look, you can see just under his wing there at the back, at his little under wing. Like, these ladybugs are so amazing. They're so tiny, and these hard-shelled wings pop up, and then there's other wings that pop out, and they can fly away. And you can see that his little wing isn't tucked in very well at the back. That's how you can tell he's a boy, because if he was a girl, he'd be tidier.
I was assuming this was part of a hand, but what part of the body do you think it is?
Well, I think your male body, I think it's a male hand, for one thing.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a male hand, which really plays up the themes of the book, because so much of the insect life is on the surface of the skin, or just under the surface.
And that's really where Sebastian starts, is he's really good at surface observation, but he has a really hard time digging deeper when he steps
yeah.
out.
But then, as you point out, maybe he's the one that is getting deeper, like in the spiritual life. Maybe his questioning does take him deeper than Tom, who isn't questioning things, who appears to be the spiritual one. So there is a paradox in there about what is deep and what is superficial.
So, and it's also a really fun love story. Tragic comic. Not tragic, but it seems
yeah.
It's an affair that doesn't seem to be... have much life left in it, to me, but...
No, but, you know, maybe it's taken Sebastian along his path. Maybe it's helped him to evolve as a person and become a more aware person and somebody who's more integrated with other people. Like, at the beginning, all the things he was learning were through bugs. He was extrapolating through what he learned about insects, and he would be then thinking about people and men through that. And then he moves on to Tom, and he tries to extrapolate through Tom to come up with rules for men, what he calls the world of men.
Which
I think is quite funny.
Could you tell me a little bit about how you brought them together?
How, sorry?
How in the book the two of them come together.
Well, there is that scene where they meet, it doesn't really say where they meet at the edge of the reception under an oak tree, in that section called Clamp and Groove at the end of part one. And... you know, I think there's a physical attraction that is just played out. And this is a common story. There's a physical attraction that's played out, and then for whatever reason, people stay together for a while after that.
But the two of them, there's like a misunderstanding sort of at the beginning of their engagement there.
Right, because there's a mention of insects, and Tom thinks there's a mention of sex, and that's the misunderstanding. And that's how they're brought together, is confusion brings them together, and then confusion is also another theme in the book. But it's this thing that brought the two of them together to begin with, this confusion over sex and insects, which reflects each of their interests. And then they merge on this thing.
Well,
yeah, that's the big foreplay scene in the book, is that section, which is maybe the biggest scene in the book in terms of sex, I'm trying to think.
Oh, when Sebastian is showing the pictures of the bugs.
Yes.
Very funny. I don't want to give too much away, but that's it's a really funny scene.
Well, you know, I did find a book later with those azure snout weevils on the cover making out of a book, and it was a book called, it's like Dr. Tatiana's Advice to Everything, and it seems to be a scientist, and people are asking her questions, or she's pretending they're people asking her questions, and she's giving them answers, like why insects do this, and it's based on their own behavior and their own life. And so that actual image of these azure snow weevils, which are amazing looking creatures to begin with, and then the two of them, you know, humping, it becomes a little bit surreal. It's like Dr. Seuss meets bug porn. And then it was on the cover of a book, which people can find, I'm sure, if they want it to.
Well,
it's amazing when you write a book and then you start seeing other little aspects of it appear in the pop culture, whether it's a lot of news stories about dead bugs or whether these azure snow weevils that I found and I thought it was obscure, but then it turns out somebody else picks it up and puts it on the cover of a book. It's amazing when you see these little things pop up in the world.
Well, Manbug certainly has resonance for us at the LBC, and I want to say thank you for doing this interview. And if there's anything else that you want to say about the book before we go, because I know that I've stolen you away from what you're supposed to be doing right now.
You haven't stolen me away from anything. I'm very excited that LBC has selected this book, and I've been looking forward to reading the other two books. They both also sound fascinating. And thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you, and I'm looking forward to the next one, and best of luck with this one, too.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
We're slipping and we're sliding in.